This morning, I have members of Wet Ink here in the studio at WMUK, and this ensemble takes the stage tonight at 7:30 p.m. to perform in the Dalton Center Recital Hall on the Bullock Performance Institute series. I'd like to welcome Sam Pluta, Eric Wubbles, Josh Modney, and Ian Antonio. Thank you for coming to WMUK.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Josh, I'm going to ask you to be the spokesman here for a little bit.
Sure.
And introduce Wet Ink, which has a nice visual to it.
Yeah, so I'm Josh Modney. I'm the violinist of Wet Ink. We're a New York City-based new music ensemble. We're a collection of composers, performers, and improvisers. And we're performing this evening with our main core ensemble, which is seven people. But also in New York, we perform as a large ensemble and call on trusted collaborators and freelancers in the New York City area to play bigger repertoire for like 20 players.
You can expand and contract as needed.
Yes, indeed. But tonight, this is our main ensemble, and we've been performing in this configuration, this septet, for about 10 years. And we've built up a repertoire around the septet. Much of it is written by the four composer members of Wet Ink.
So there are four of you who conceive of pieces and write the pieces for the group to play, and sometimes with actual personalities and members in mind?
Yeah. The music is very much like by the group, for the group, and it's come from many years of close collaboration between the performers and the composer of each particular piece.
Do you think that produces a more stylized or personal kind of music as opposed to a composer who would be writing for a generic kind of ensemble?
Yeah, totally. The traditional model that people with classical training are used to is that you just receive a piece and you work on it on your own. The composer works on their own, conceptualizing the piece, and then turns it over to the performer who practices it. And there's not a whole lot of communication except for maybe, you know, a rehearsal before the premiere. But our working model is to work on the pieces together with composer and performer right from the beginning and go through multiple steps of revision. And when we get to the premiere, it's just like the first step.
Sam, as you're here representing the composer side of this.
Too. Yeah, well, I just wanted to add that I think that model is is not totally unique in new concert music, but historically it's not unique at all. And if you think about, for like the classical music audience, if you think about the Queen of the Night aria by Mozart, he certainly was not writing that aria for just any soprano, right? He was writing for somebody who he knew could do this crazy thing, and he wrote it for that person's personality. So we're lucky enough to have that kind of relationship with our performers that I think those kinds of musicians had 200 years ago.
Do you think it's actually more true than not that composers generally knew or were pretty confident of the abilities of who they were writing for?
I would think so. I mean, you know, these scenes of musical in musical history are generally local scenes. You know, they're local musical scenes where people are making music for people they know, and you know, even the areas. You know, these were not big towns. I mean, the population of the Vienna or whatever at the time of Beethoven was like 50,000 people. So, and, you know, he's writing for people who live in the area or people that are coming through that he knows that are, you know, ooh, there's this exciting violinist coming through, you know. So, yeah, I think that historically that would probably be the most normal way of working.
You have a piece on the program tonight, Mr. Pluta, yes?
Yeah, I do.
Where do you draw the line for input? I mean, do you have to create a safe bubble for a while you write the piece and then invite some?
Yeah, I mean, the piece has, I think my music in particular really leans on the personalities of the performers in a way that there's not everything's on the page even. I mean, there's aspects of it that, you know, Ian and Alex are improvising a lot of the time. Then Eric and Aaron, so flute and piano, are playing this like stream of notes that's just kind of endless. But even within that, like even though all the notes are there, I don't expect them to even, it's not even like, I'm not even expecting them to play all the notes. You know, it's a very strange relationship with notation and what I actually want. So what's nice about working with people you know is that you feel confident in writing this thing that might not be totally right. And then they can, because they also understand your personality, they can embrace it and make it right.
Are you the same kind of composer, Eric?
I think to a certain extent, yes. I think Sam brings up a great point about the role of notation in the history of this tradition, too. And I think one of the things that's we've discovered is that there's so much that you can communicate in a kind of verbal setting or face-to-face, and that must always have been the case. You know, if you go back historically, there's always this oral tradition aspect to it. And we just lose that a little bit as history kind of moves along. But so it's interesting to go through a process like this, I think, for us and rediscover that how important and vital and detailed you can get with language and with relationships in addition to notation on the page. And then even go back and reconsider that historically as being, you know, part of the process. For me, I think in the pieces that I've written for the group, the piece that we'll do tonight, Katachi, for example, it's pretty specific. It's very detailed, very specified on the page. But that has to do with just a particular, I think, aim artistically in the piece that requires a high level of detail and specificity. But the great thing about working with this particular group, I think for all of us, is just the range and versatility of the musicians to deal with any one of those notational scenarios, ranging from completely improvised contexts to things that are rigorously specified and extremely precise.
And because Ian hasn't had a chance to join the conversation yet, do you also write music or do you mostly play new music?
I'm mostly a performer. I don't consider myself a performer composer, although I definitely enjoy experimenting with sounds on percussion and write things probably more suited to my students' educational needs, but not for a concert setting.
And you live in the New York area?
I do. I live in Queens, New York.
Okay. Yeah. And you perform with Wet Ink and what other group?
My other main performing group is Yarn Wire, which is a two piano, two percussion ensemble. So probably the logistically most illogical group to form, but it's a fun combination of sounds. And I also play with Talajan, which is a percussion ensemble that's been around for close to two decades now. So,
did you start playing drums or percussion early on?
I did, yeah. My dad is a percussionist, so I grew up watching him teach private lessons out in one of the rooms in our house. There's pictures of me kind of peering in through the glass windows before my own memory. So I think I kind of learned through osmosis a little bit early on.
Would you go down the instrument list for this group that we'll hear tonight, Wet Ink?
Sure. Yep. So there's seven of us here today. And Aaron Lesser is the flautist. Alex Minchak will be playing saxophone. Eric Wubbles is on piano. I will be playing percussion. Josh Modney on violin. Kate Soper is a soprano. And Sam Pluta is the electronics wizard.
Wow. What can't you do?
Well, with Sam, there's not a whole lot that that we can't do sound-wise. So, but yeah.
Josh, I wonder, there's usually a string section. You know, you usually have some sort of a force in numbers ensembles, but you're this sole string player in the group. Is it a different voice in that sense?
Yeah. There's a tradition of mixed ensemble playing for string players that's a little more recent, like Stravinsky, Histoire du Soldat, which just has a solo violin and a bass, or like the Schoenberg, Piero Lunaire, it's violin and cello, and many subsequent pieces that put strings in a mixed setting, sometimes as a soloist. And it's a much different style of playing than string quartet, where everything is blended and balanced. And it's really more like playing a solo piece or a concerto, in that like the dynamic range tends to be on the louder side. Or sometimes we use amplification because violin is probably the quietest instrument in this ensemble.
True. Do you get to do both in your occupations? You do get to do both this group and other more string-centric projects.
Yeah, well, when we do our large ensemble projects, we often have a string section. Yeah. And then I also play with the International Contemporary Ensemble, or ICE, which does a variety of chamber and large configurations, many times involving strings en masse.
You come to Kalamazoo and various cities on tours and things, and you talk to people like me who are like still getting the hang of contemporary ensembles and how it all works. It must feel completely normal to you at this point, just practicing modern music, going to and playing modern music concerts is just a way of life.
Yeah, and it's one that...
And I'm still here with big eyes and like surprise and wow, how do you do it?
It's a way of life that I think we all feel grateful for because of the variety and just creativity that comes with it. That's certainly different from the way I was trained going to conservatory. I feel like through playing with Wet Ink, I've come to value creativity in a way that wouldn't have happened if I might have pursued other career options for a violinist.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Anybody else have a comment on that?
Yeah, I was thinking what the variety of our lives is really exciting. And, you know, some weekends you're doing something, you're off somewhere playing, or you're... and then a lot of us teach, so then you're teaching, and then, you know, if you compose, now that's a totally different way of making music, and then if you improvise, that's a totally different way of making music, and, you know, we've done recording projects, and we've done, you know, mixing an album, and, like, there's all these, it's really exciting to be able to explore all these different ways of human expression. I sometimes it's a little overwhelming, actually, when you're thinking, oh, my goodness, I can't believe tomorrow I'm going to, or like today, I can't believe today I'm going to wake up at 5 a.m. And drive 2.5 hours to Kalamazoo. But that's also exciting. That's a really awesome opportunity to be able to do that kind of thing.
Does playing and being absorbed in the world of new music, new writing techniques, so many different voices, does it actually help you appreciate the history that it comes from? Can you hear older music in a new light this way?
Absolutely.
This is Eric.
Yeah, and I think being a part of a tradition that is still living and growing and evolving is extremely exciting, I think, to all of us. But as exactly as you say, when you're in the midst of something like that, it kind of forces you to look back and say, well, this was clearly how it was, you know, how it felt or what it was like in those situations as well. So where can you find linkages? What do you see in common? And, you know, that music is as exciting, certainly, I think, in its own time. And it's possible to rediscover the novelty and the... really sort of avant-garde characteristics of music that historically has come to seem sort of canonical and maybe in some cases a little bit straight-laced. But I think if you just dig a little bit, you can find in a lot of cases incredible invention and excitement in that, and just inspiration too. I think for you know, several of us as composers, you know, we listen to all kinds of music, you know, contemporary pop music, improvised music. But right along with that, Bach and Beethoven would be, you know, for me personally, just in my very highest rankings of musicians. So I think having a way to these days just have all of that stuff kind of kicking around in your head is a really vital and inspiring place to be.
That's Eric Wubbles, who is a composer for Wet Ink and the keyboardist or pianist for the group. And the concert tonight kicks off with a piece by Eric Wubbles. And I'd like to have you introduce some of the ideas in the piece, and then we have a chance to hear it in a commercially released recording from Wet Ink.
Sure. So this piece is called Katachi. It's from a couple years back, 2010 or 11. And this is a piece that was written for this Wet Ink septet configuration. And as we've kind of touched on a little bit, the group is composed of these seven individuals. And the reason that we have this instrumentation is entirely based on the personalities and the people. So there's no other group that has this instrumentation prior to us. So it wasn't about, we want a flute to add to this, we want a violin to add to this. It was really just these people come together and form a really interesting artistic collective. So in a lot of the pieces that we had written, that the group had been playing prior to this piece, I think we really explored everyone's different backgrounds. You know, so Alex is a saxophonist coming from jazz. Kate is a vocalist having a sort of singer-songwriter background, some being improvisers, some being kind of conservatory trained, exploring all those personalities. And so in this group, I tried to do something kind of the opposite of that and explore the other side, which is there a way to take these seven completely different instruments and personalities and find a space in which they can really blend and interact as equals? And so this piece, Katachi, is a series of basically etudes or studies in sections. And in each one, it's a different way of solving that kind of riddle of how do you get violin, electronics, soprano voice, piano, percussion, flute, saxophone to interact and blend in a way in which they're not just fulfilling the role or the personality of that instrument, but they're this sort of one thing, this new kind of meta instrument together.
It serves as a great introduction to Wet Ink, which performs tonight at 7:30 in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Tickets are available through the Miller Auditorium box office. That's milleraudatorium.com or 387-2300. That's a bracing introduction to Wet Ink, a piece by Eric Wubbles called Katachi. We've heard the very first movement of this piece, which, Eric, you say you wrote as a way of kind of getting out your creative ideas on how to bring together all these disparate sounds and players and personalities.
Yeah, for sure. I think that was one of the main challenges as we figured out with this group of seven individuals, how are we going to work together? You know, how are we going to make these things blend as sounds? And Josh talked a little bit, I think your question was great, about, you know, having a solo string instrument instead of having a group of strings. And one of the things that we've sort of struggled with in figuring out how to make this group work sonically, acoustically, is the lack of bass instruments, for example. So there's no cello, there's no bass. And we have to use piano, we have to use low percussion, we have to use electronics to generate kind of bass resonance. So as we sort of got used to working with this particular very odd assemblage of instruments, there's just technical challenges to that of how do you make it sound good? And that's, I think, one of the things that we're all as composers really fixated on, and we have in deeply in common, that kind of drew us together, is interested in things that, you know, however we would define them to ourselves, but things that sound good. We're really interested in sound per se.
One of the main aspects of the piece to my ears is the dependence on sharing this rhythmic motive, and which would just naturally bring a group together. You have to, you know, pass off these musical lines.
Right. Yeah. And I think one of the traditions that I'm drawing on in a piece like this is, well, in the Western tradition, usually you would have the lines divided according to their function and assigned to instruments. So you would have someone playing a rhythm and they would stick with the rhythm, someone playing the melody and they would sort of hold the melody. But you can find examples in, you know, other parts of the world, say in Balinese gamelan music, where there's a more communal sense of what a line is, and it's distributed among players, actually. So one thing that you hear is a melody is actually played by two or three people. One person takes one note, the next person takes the next note, and kind of hock it pattern or something like that. And there's a musical interest to that. But there's also an aspect of it that I think is explicitly social and is intended to be. It generates community. It generates interdependence.
Sure.
And since the social aspect of the group is so important to us, you know, it really matters who we are as people and our relationships with each other. I was interested in exploring that, just what the sort of structural musical consequences of that kind of idea could be in a piece.
The concert begins with your piece, Katachi, at 7:30 tonight, and full details at wmish.edu/music/events if you want to see the full program. And what it continues with is Kate Soper's piece, Voices from the Killing Jar. Where does it go compared to what we just heard?
Yeah, so Kate's piece is a showcase for the range of her voice and her artistic personality. It's a song cycle, basically. And each movement of the cycle is focused on a different female protagonist from a literary work. So we're going to hear two of the movements of that piece tonight. The first, I believe, is Lady Macduff from Macbeth. And the last movement of the piece that we'll do, Daisy Buchanan from The Great Gatsby. And so in each of these movements, she's exploring a different kind of stylistic and aesthetic scenario, a different way in which her voice as a soloist interacts with the ensemble of Wet Ink. And in this piece, Kate sort of showcases the whole range of her background as a performer. So she plays piano while singing. She plays clarinet in one of the movements as well. So a really huge range, and musicians of Wet Ink as well. I think we all play all of our auxiliary instruments, and I have to play recorder. Josh plays trumpet in one of the movements.
I actually sing a Mozart aria at one point, which I will not sing tonight.
But she really drew on everyone's background to sort of exploit the full range of dramatic possibilities in the group.
We have to talk about how the friendships were made. A lot of groups come in and say, we met in graduate school or something like that. Were some relationships formed that way in Wet Ink or no?
Yeah, school was part of some of the relationships, but it spans over a few years.
This is Josh Modney.
Yes. The group, our founding member is Alex Minchek, and he was at MSM, Manhattan School of Music, at the time that the group started. And Ian and Aaron joined soon after through relationship at Manhattan School.
Alex is a saxophonist.
Yes.
And he was interested in new music as opposed to going into classical or jazz or something.
He was studying jazz at the time, but then he shifted into composition and ended up going to Columbia University, which is how the group really came together in its current form.
Actually, I have a question. Ian, did you and Alex start working together when you were undergrads or in master's program?
When I met Alex, I was an undergrad, and I believe he was a graduate student. Mm. And so I was kind of, when Wet Ink first started, it was more of a presenting organization that would kind of bring in other groups and present them under the auspices of Wet Ink music productions or something like that. And I think I was brought in as a performer early on, and same with Aaron. But it gradually shifted more towards this kind of stable composer, performer, ensemble.
Yeah, I mean, when we were talking about when they met, it was 1998, so it's almost 20 years ago, and then the group has kind of formed slowly over time. So Eric joined the group in 2005, and then Kate around 2006, and then I met Eric and Alex at a German music festival, Darmstadt, in 2006, and I joined the group in about 2007, 2008. And Josh started playing with us around that time. And at that point, you know, there were many people who were regularly playing with the group. You know, sometimes people would fall off. But since that time, it's this core group of people have been making music together.
Is it always easy, or are there times when it's actually a real, you know, challenge to bring a concert together, to agree on a piece, how it's interpreted?
Well, I think the music making process for us is actually maybe one of the easier parts. Maybe I'm only speaking for myself, but logistically, Wet Ink has been able to kind of get over a few bumps, people moving to different parts of the country. But I think since we all share a vision of this collaborative music making, we incentivize coming together and spending time making music together. And so when we are in the same room, I think we really value that time and focus in on making music together.
Yeah. And I mean, we're also seven artists. So, you know, we are...
People have personalities.
Yeah, we have personalities. And that's and so you just have to, you know people's personalities and yeah, you deal with it.
The goal is to make a concert happen.
Yeah. And I think we wouldn't want it any other way. I mean, yes, people can have their thing, but that also comes through in their music, which makes it exciting and thrilling to listen to. So
have you won any awards that we should know about? Like, is this a sort of competitive thing, or I think of Wet Ink in the same breath as some of the other top New York groups. Sorry, would you say your colleagues with ICE and Alarm Will Sound and groups like that?
Yeah, well, actually, Aaron, the flute player, is a member of Alarm Will Sound, and so I think there's a lot of kind of cross pollination. Mm-hmm. Amongst the groups based in New York and around New York. It's a very collaborative community. I think it's we're all advocates for each other and know that we need to kind of represent each other and the music we're making positively. And I think there's a lot of good, just good feelings around.
People in the other groups are as likely to be in your audience as you are to be
for
in
sure.
theirs.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. A few more things that we can chat about this hour include how Sam incorporates electronics into the group. We have other pieces to look at, but I want to remind people that the concert is at 7:30 tonight. And if you arrive at 7 p.m., you'll have a chance to hear some behind the scenes comments from members of the group in a live and interactive session that's part of the Bullock Performance Institute series. Details online at wmich.edu/music/events. And I'd like to take a break for one of the Kate Soper songs that you've recorded on the album Relay. Will this be available at the concert tonight? In your album?
We have a few copies that will be available.
Okay. Dear copies that you have to personally ask for, I would.
Yeah.
You might get one. Let's hear, this is one of the shorter songs in her set called Only the Words Themselves Mean What They Say, with text by Lydia Davis.
Getting to know your body. If your eyeballs move, this means that you're thinking or about to start thinking.
That's Kate Soper of Wet Ink and a piece she composed. I was not expecting that, you guys. I queued it up hearing from you that she was a jazz singer, and I thought it would just be really melodic. And yet I was totally drawn in by this unity between flute and voice. How in the world is that achieved? It's amazing.
What's amazing is that, I mean, we just saw them play that piece 2 weeks ago in Wisconsin from memory, and it's an incredibly complicated score. But yeah, Kate's just done a great job working out these like intricate sonic, kind of like Eric and Katachi, these sonic similarities between the voice and the flute, and both Aaron and Kate are so versatile with their instruments. They're able to kind of shape their own instrument to match that of the other human. It's virtuosic compositionally and performatively.
You know, what's also fun about listening to new music is not realizing which instrument or who it is making that sound, how it is achieved. It's a puzzle. Even just listening to the recording, I thought a saxophone was a flute, and you just don't know. All the expected is now unexpected.
There's a wonderful moment earlier in that piece in a different movement where Aaron is singing into her flute and Kate's mouth is moving, but Kate's not singing, and you really can't tell when you're watching what's going on. You know there's something wrong because your brain is telling you, but you can't figure it out. So it's definitely something that she's interested in that piece.
This is Sam Pluta I'm speaking with. And actually, Sam, I'd like to continue with you because your role as the player of electronics in the group is a bit of a mystery to me. I'm curious what it is you do to prepare for these shows.
Yeah, I mean, I think electronics in a way ends up being a lot like percussion, like what Ian does, in that, except with less counting, I think. Where it's an instrument that can do so many different things.
That's why it's hard to imagine.
Yeah. That you have to, that each piece is totally different. So the approach to how I play Katachi is, especially Katachi has like so many different, even just in that piece, so many different approaches to playing electronics. And then in my piece, it's what I'm doing this piece that we're going to hear, which is not on the concert, but it's on our album. I'm taking the saxophone and I'm putting a microphone on it, and then I'm taking that sound and I'm manipulating it electronically and spitting it back out. So there's a very highly notated part for the ensemble, and then the saxophone and I are improvising on top. Sometimes I'm doing something as simple as playing a sine wave, just like a simple tone. And other times I'm making like huge walls of sound. So I think the beauty of one of the things I've been thinking about is treating the instrument as just an instrument, because you can treat electronics as like an ensemble. You can think of it as an orchestra. It can make all, you know, I could put 20 speakers in a room and I can make the sound of an orchestra if I want. But if I think of it as an instrument, then I have this like intimate relationship with other instruments. At some point, I think I realized personally that I didn't want to, you know, I could go in a studio and make studio music, mm-hmm. but then I'm alone all the time and I'm sad. and it's not a good place for me. I like dealing with other humans. So in this situation, I kind of act as just a single instrument, and I try to complement the group and deal with like interactions with the other instruments.
What is setup like for you? What do you have to check? What do you array in front of you?
Yeah, it's different every show. So the show tonight has so many different approaches. So in Kate's piece, I have a microphone on Kate, and I'm doing a vocoder on her, which is kind of like a electronic voice sound. And then I have mics on the saxophone and the flute to do another part of the piece. In Eric's piece, I have a microphone in front of the ensemble where I'm taking the sound of the whole ensemble and just doing really simple delays. Actually, the track, when you played Katachi, I'm actually playing there, but it's so subtle, and in the background you can't really even tell that it's there, which is an aspect of the orchestration. So trying to match the orchestration that Eric's already done. And then in my piece, I have speakers behind the ensemble, and these speakers have microphones in front of them, and they're feeding back the whole time. So actually the setup for tonight is pretty complex. Sometimes it's really simple, and it's basically different every show.
Have you ever had to assemble or build your own device for a specific piece of music?
Yeah. I mean, my main piece of software is this like modular piece of software where I can keep adding ideas to it. So for instance, in Alex's piece for tonight, I have a piece of software, and Eric's piece, and Kate's, basically all the pieces for tonight, I built a different piece of software to do what the music needs to do. I'm a very software guy, so I do hardware stuff, but it's not really my thing. I'm more of a code person.
Is this something you have in common with Western's faculty member, Christopher Biggs?
Yeah, absolutely. I met Christopher about 12 years ago, and I'm not sure, and we've emailed since, but I'm not sure we've actually seen each other. But yeah, and you know, I think he and I, even at that time, were pursuing very similar things. So it's exciting to see him again and see what he's been up to.
Yeah, which could be something completely different from what you're doing. And was it week before last, I talked to a composer named Jeff Harriet, who also seems to work in the same way. Or not.
No, music technology is a continuum of you know, we've been talking about history and our, you know, thinking about historical music. Well, I always think about things like the violin. The violin is a piece of technology, or the horn, and the horn is a piece of technology, and the way that those pieces of technology changed music. So you can't have these with the viol, the instrument before the violin, you can't have the kind of flourishy, fast playing that you get in Vivaldi. So basically you wouldn't have Vivaldi without the violin. And the horn, you know, the like in the 19th century, the horn used to be unvalved, and then it could only play in one key. Well, once the horn could play in all keys, then you can have this like big orchestral music that modulates into all keys, and you have Mahler and Bruckner and late romantic orchestral music, and then you get Schoenberg and atonal music because these instruments can play all the notes. But before they couldn't, so keys were really, really important. So the way that technology has influenced music, which is significant, is, you know, electronic technology has been the recent piece of technology doing that. And I wonder what the next one is. That's where I'm excited to think about.
Well, time for a round of kind of final thoughts and ideas for people who want to attend tonight's concert, which again begins at 7:30 p.m. in the Dalton Center Recital Hall. Wet Ink appearing. It's a seven piece group tonight.
Yes.
It's the core group. And there is a live and interactive portion at 7 p.m. if you want to hear a little more from the members of the group. So, Josh Modney, what do you think about people wanting to come tonight?
Well, I'd like to add to what Sam was saying. If you're trying to imagine what an electronics performance looks like, Sam will not be sitting in a chair and pressing spacebar on a computer. He's spent years developing software and hardware interface that allow him to interact with his instrument with the same fluency that you can interact with a violin or a saxophone, so that it's a performance practice that can be developed over time and that he can practice and communicate in an extremely musical way.
That's really valuable to know. Well, I still can't picture it, but I can't. Yeah. But now it'd be really cool to find out. Do you have anything to add, Eric?
Yeah, I guess I would just say for folks who might not have any idea what to expect musically, that the variety of types of music and aesthetics that will be playing on the concert tonight have as much to do with electronic music, noise music, improvised music, in Kate's piece, medieval music, in Anthony Braxton's piece, what you might recognize as kind of jazz combo playing, as they do with the classical tradition. So there's an extremely broad range of style that's all bound together, I think, for us by just an interest in the direct experience of sound and kind of joy in the beauty of sound. So I don't think there are really any barriers to enjoying that up front. It's not like you need to know the whole history of all these things, even though all that stuff is in our head. But we really do think it is something that's immediate and visceral and accessible right off the bat.
How about you, Ian?
Yeah, all I'd say is that on CD and record, these pieces are great to experience as a pure listening experience, but seeing them and experiencing them live adds a totally extra dimension. And so I'd really recommend coming tonight to the show. There's a lot of energy on stage, a lot of kind of like audience, performer, energy, interaction and feedback. And it's an exciting show. So.
And Sam, the last piece is yours, called Broken Symmetries. Would you give us a quick introduction?
Yeah, Well, is that what we're going to... No, we're going to listen to ATD5, right?
You're right. You don't You don't have a recording.
Well, that's it. You know, we recorded it 2 weeks ago, so it's not done yet. I haven't mixed it. If I had, I could have brought it in. Both of these pieces, so ATD5, this is all about me interacting with Alex. So Alex is on the saxophone, I'm on the electronics, and then the ensemble has this notated part. And it's a very, my music tends to be physically intense, I guess. And I like music with drums and, you know, I grew up on rock and roll and I like that kind of energy in my music.
Oh, you know what? We forgot to have the Chicago new music scene, you know, pride versus New York, which is represented by three of you all, 3-1 here.
Yeah, I mean, there's great. Chicago is one of the best new music scenes in the country, and as is New York. So it's really exciting. I just moved there this year, so to see the vibrancy of the scene there is really, really awesome. There's so many good groups and so many different people doing lots of great things, and what I see is a lot of crosstalk between like Chicago and New York and in Los Angeles as well. So one of the exciting things of the music scene in this country moving out of New York, because it kind of is, it used to be very centered there and it's kind of moving out, but it's that there's, you know, it's more spread out and there's more going on across the country. And there's people across the country experiencing this music firsthand in really strong and palpable ways.
Even here in Kalamazoo, and especially advocated for by Lisa Kunz and Christopher Biggs on the faculty at Western Michigan University, bringing outstanding ensembles like Wet Ink into town to kind of blow our minds. Good luck in tonight's concert. This, Sam, is your recording of, you called it ATD5, but yeah. It's American
Tokyo Daydream 5. Thank you.